said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Joel Bachman, who, like myself, grew up in Michigan. He was from East Lansing. I was from Detroit. He's a professor of law at the University of British Columbia and a legal scholar. He's a former Rhodes Scholar, and he has got law degrees from Oxford, Dalhousie, and Harvard. He has created a new book, which will be the subject of our conversation today, called The New Corporation, How, quote, good corporations are bad for democracy. He's also made a film with the same title, a documentary film co-directed with Jennifer Abbott. And previously, he made a very, very profound film and documentary, both by the title of The Corporation. The book, The New Corporation, is available in the United States through Vintage Books, Penguin Random House, and is titled, the subtitle of your new documentary is The Unfortunately Necessary Sequel. So let's start with this whole line of work. And you and I have talked before. I believe you've quoted me in some of your work. What inspired you, and what has the pandemic done to add to your inspiration? And then we'll get to the question of, given this work and your previous work, why was the sequel necessary?
Yeah, well, first I want to start by saying, Rob, thanks for having me on, and also thanks for all the work that you do, and you're absolutely right that I quote you, because you've had a lot of really important things to say, so thank you. In terms of what inspires me to do this work, I guess I come at it. I started as a legal scholar interested in the corporation as a legal institution. And so the first book and film, The Corporation, began as an academic project where I asked myself the question, how have we put this institution together as a matter of law? And what are the social and political economic impacts of how we've done that, of its legal makeup? And as I say, that began as an academic project. It quickly morphed into a documentary film and a book that was written for more popular consumption, because I thought nobody had really looked at this question in a kind of popular way. People had looked at this or that corporation, this or that industry, this or that issue, but they hadn't kind of stripped it down and said, what have we created in this institution, and what are the impacts of what we've created? So I thought that was something that needed to go beyond academic audiences. And so I made that film, wrote that book. And I was most interested in the fact that we have created this institution and conferred upon it personhood. We've said that even though it's an inanimate thing, it's not a living thing, and it's really a collective of shareholders, we are going to magically, like an act of alchemy, turn it into a person so that it has the same and sometimes more rights and responsibilities as well as a human being. Because the law only confers rights on human beings, on persons, so in order for an entity to have rights, it needs to be magically transformed into a person. That's what the law does. So then I asked, well, what kind of person is it if it's a person? And one of the other principles of corporate law that are imbued in this institution is what's called the best interest of the corporation rule. And in short, that means that everything managers and directors do have to be reasonably connected to the best interests of the institution, and which means of its shareholders. And I thought, well, that's very strange. We've got this person, and we've said that this person has to always act in its own self-interest. If that were a human being that was only capable of acting in its own self-interest and not having regard for others, we'd probably diagnose that human being as a psychopath. So that became the central idea of that first work. In the second work, I take that idea further. By the time the second work comes along, and you know, it was just released a few weeks ago, so I was making it since about 2016, 2015, the world is in severe crisis. And that crisis is connected to how these entities, corporations, operate in the world. And without getting into the second question of what inspired the second work, suffice it to say that the second work paints with a much broader brush than the first. Rather than simply looking at this institution and its impacts, it tries to look at the entirety of corporate capitalism and its relationship with democracy. And the threat it poses to democracy, drawing in Trump's victory, drawing in COVID, drawing in the recent uprisings, the Black Lives Matter uprisings. So it's a much broader enterprise, and it very much connects to the current crisis we're in, the pandemic, which is featured in both the book and the film, as demonstrating several things. One is the failures of the system that has been created largely through the pressure exerted by big business in the United States to push back social infrastructure, push back public health provision, push back social provision, push back corporate taxes, that all of this left the United States gutted in terms of its capacity to respond to this crisis. And I think when compared to other countries with more robust social systems, it's very clear that the United States has failed miserably in its response to the pandemic. So that's one thing that the pandemic has shown. A second thing is that this idea that I develop in the book and film, that corporations have been pushing this idea that they are the solution to the world's problems, I think the pandemic really very quickly and profoundly put a lie to that idea. Because the main thing that corporations were doing in the face of pandemics were lining up for bailouts from taxpayers, as opposed to taking real leadership roles in trying to address what was happening. And so I think another thing that sort of another lie that we've been that has been foisted upon us over the last 40 years, that governments are not important, that governments shouldn't be taking the lead on social issues, that government should be diminished, what a lot of academics describe as a neoliberal idea. I think that idea has also been really thoroughly criticized by just the facts as they've unfolded, as we've seen that really the only institution in our society capable of mounting a response to a crisis of this magnitude is government. And that those countries like New Zealand, like Canada, like other countries where governments have taken very proactive leadership roles in combating the effects of the virus have been much more successful. And I think a sort of final myth of neoliberalism, and perhaps this is the most profound effect of the COVID crisis, this idea that we are primarily individuals in competition with one another, that we all operate in our own little individualist pods with our white picket fences around us and our interests. This notion of radical individualism, of radical self-interest, this idea that has very much fueled conceptions of who we are, especially over the last 40 years. I think that idea is also challenged by COVID in a very, I think, promising and positive way. Because as soon as the pandemic hit, what we saw was this bursting out of humanity, of people creating communal mutual aid societies, of people helping those who were in isolation, of people recognizing that how they act as individuals inevitably and profoundly impacts other individuals, how we're all interdependent. I think it's very hard to hold on to that idea, though I am perfectly aware that many people are holding on to it these days. But I think it's hard to sensibly hold on to this idea of the sort of rugged individual that's such an important part of American cultural life in the face of this pandemic, in the face of a threat that just radically and scientifically shows how interdependent we are. You know, if I don't wear a mask, I put my loved ones at risk. If I don't help somebody, an isolated elderly person who's my neighbor, they won't be helped. So that I'm hoping, and I'm cautiously hopeful, may be the most profound lesson that we learned from this, that we are much fuller human beings than this neoliberal ideal of rugged individualism suggests.
I want to unpack a number of different elements that you've been exploring, the first of which is the despondency about governments. Many people, and I believe it was in your film, show that scene of Ronald Reagan saying government is the problem, not the solution. And while, how would I say, the people who benefit from relief of government may be ultra interested in promoting that, there was an episode after the great financial crisis that I recall, an unnamed Obama official said, we can't go back and be like FDR in the New Deal. And it was an undisclosed senior official, but he said, we got a problem, which is when you look at the surveys, the population doesn't believe in the government. And there's a gentleman, an artist from New York, who did a wonderful podcast on this. His name's Stuart Zechman, and I can share it with you and with our audience. This podcast talked about Zechman thinking that was curious and going to the data. And when he got to the data at Gallup, I'll paraphrase, what he found was that people on the progressive side, in fact, did not trust in governance because they thought it was captured and being used to subsidize power and corporations and plutocrats to their expense. And so it's sort of what you might call fed the fire of libertarian alternatives or perhaps despondency and withdrawing from participation. And so I think this question of can government regain trust? Can government demonstrate something that gives you faith in their expertise and faith in the breadth of their representativeness has a lot to do with that corporate personhood and what I call the commodification of social design.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you're hitting on really the key issue here. And there are a number of things to be said about it. I think probably the most chilling moment in the film and the book is when I'm interviewing Richard Edelman, actually in exactly the same spot I interviewed you, Rob, in Davos in the main square. And for those who don't know, Richard Edelman is kind of the business guru of business gurus, the prognosticator of prognosticators of where things are going in the business world.
He does a lot of work for the World Economic Forum as well. And I worked with Richard on the campaign when Ned Lamont, who's now governor of Connecticut, challenged Joe Lieberman in 2006. And we had a very good experience working together. anyway, back to
he's absolutely he's a delightful man, and he's very much on the side of good, on the side of the good corporation, and believing that corporations can be good actors. And at one point in this film and in the book, he says, I'm not much of a believer in political citizenship. I believe in the power of the marketplace, especially with corporations being good actors. And for me, that is the kind of chilling moment in the film, because what it shows is, in effect, a giving up on democracy, because political citizenship is a democratic system. Marketplaces are not democratic. And so when the good guys in the business world are, in effect, giving up on democracy, when corporations are saying we can do a better job of governance than governments can, I think we're in a lot of trouble. At the same time, you're absolutely right that a lot of progressive people have also given up on government because they believe that government is unduly influenced by the corporate world. And they're right. Government is unduly influenced by the corporate world. So what we have and what we've had is this very strange dynamic where, and you know, even the best novelists probably couldn't imagine this story, but basically corporations reposition themselves, and this is a story I tell in the book, corporations reposition themselves in the early 2000s as being good actors. They say, in effect, okay, we agree with you. We have been acting psychopathically. Now we're going to be the good guys. And not only are we going to be the good guys in terms of doing less harm in the world, but we're going to take the lead in doing good. So when you go now to McDonald's or Coca-Cola or Nike or BP or any of these websites, you may think you've accidentally hit upon an NGO or an activist group. It's all about doing good in the world. So the corporation recasts itself in this way. It then leverages that idea over the ensuing years, as I document in the book, to make a play for more and more power and less regulation and fewer taxes. So now the neoliberal agenda of pushing back government is being done in the guy, you know, the wolf in sheep's clothing and all of that. It's being done that, hey, we care about the world. We're publicly minded now. So let us run your schools. Let us run your water systems. Don't tax us. Let markets do these things. We don't need political citizenship anymore. We now have corporations operating as good actors and markets taking care of all these problems. And so the government becomes this diminished, corporate-controlled, corporate-influenced entity that is very hard to respect if you're a progressive person. And so you start to get libertarianism on the left as well as libertarianism on the right. The problem with all of this, of course, is that where does democracy end up in all of it? Because at least in terms of our current structure, without sort of turning everything upside down, and if we look at the past, that doesn't always work, revolutions and things like that, the only way that we have as a society to act collectively to protect and promote our collective interests, whether it's the environment or social equality or justice or any of these things, is government. Is democratic government and the institutions of democratic government. And I think that people are starting to recognize that now. One of the main through lines, one of the main storylines in both the book and film is that there has been this shift among activists, where in the early 2000s, in the anti-globalization movement, activists went into the streets and protested. And then they said, you know, and this is the story I tell in the book, you know, this isn't really working. Corporate capitalism isn't changing. So now let's occupy the squares. Let's, you know, sit down and sort of enact what participatory democracy would look like in Zuccotti Park, or in the Central Square in Barcelona and Madrid, or in the Arab Spring, and so on. So let's occupy major cities and make these sort of model democracies. And so that was tried throughout 2011. We had all of these movements around the world, and that didn't work either. So the story that I show, I try to link the energy that comes out of the Occupy movement. I look at a few Occupy activists who said, one of them is now the mayor of Barcelona. She was part of the Spanish equivalency to the Occupy movement, the M15 movement. And I look at Shama Sawant, a city councilor in Seattle, who was also part of the movement. I look at people involved in the Sanders movement. And what I show is how there was a sense among people after Occupy didn't work that the next stage was to occupy government, that government was still democratic enough that it was possible to bring these ideas about participatory democracy, ideas about social democracy, ideas about social justice, ideas about sustainability of the environment, to bring these ideas into government. So the problem that, you know, government is just not fixable, that this idea among activists was kind of shed. And we ended up with the AOCs. We ended up with Sanders. I mean, Sanders' campaign in 2016 was energized and animated and organized by a lot of former Occupy activists. So there was a real shift between 2012 and roughly 2014, 2016 among people in so-called progressive sectors thinking, we need to make a play for government. I think that's what Sanders represented, and that's what many local politicians, Mayor Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi, of all places, a very progressive African-American activist, democratic socialist, you know, and you see this throughout the United States in many locales, in Chicago, the city council, as I mentioned, AOC, but also many people who joined her in 2018, Katie Porter. So I think that we are seeing a shift among progressive towards the view that, yes, government is broken. Yes, government is unduly influenced by business, but the job isn't to simply poo-poo it and protest against it. The job is to change that. And that is the story, I think. That is the message of both the book and film, that yes, we need to be in the streets, but we also need to be in government. And we need to find synergies between being in civil society and protesting and advocating and being activists, and also working with and within government.
Let me continue to, how you say, unpack this for an audience at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. You take a person like the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. In his most famous book, Moral Man and Immoral Society, he essentially advocated that the enlightenment of the powerful was not an adequate system, that one had to constrain them with the institutions of governance. You move on in time, and by the way, I'll say this around Niebuhr's thinking. When theologians think it's pointless to what you might call experience the good in a powerful individual, that's an interesting notion unto itself, because it's part of what they're trying to engender and spread throughout the spirit of society. And right. Then I look at the Lewis Powell memo in the early 70s, profit compression, anti-war movement, civil rights movement. And Powell wrote a memo, I think it was for the Chamber of Commerce. He was subsequently would be a Supreme Court justice. But at some level, it was, we got to take back the universities. We got to change upstream the notion of right and wrong in a way that's what you might call much more amenable to corporate vitality. And the Powell memo essentially was that not really, it was interesting because it was saying, we got to change the ideas and the philosophy that inspire people. Well, then in a more recent time, you get into this, like you mentioned, AOC, the Squad, Katie Porter and others. And you have this ideology, and you have what Donald Trump said in 2016, the system is rigged, money politics is pervasive, but it seems to have lost legitimacy. The system and the, what I call Powell through Reagan wave of legitimacy and modified slightly by the neoliberals gets to a place where the results on environment, on inequality, on law enforcement, prison industrial system, and all of these things, are people are saying, I don't care what you say, your ideas aren't working. But are we now at a place where ideas are in one place, but what you might call muscle and control of institutions is another place, and what you might call despondency and conflict are on the rise? How do we heal this place? Is it in the realm of ideas? Is it in the realm of activism? Is it in the realm of what you might call a surgical diagnosis as to where to focus your activism? What do you see?
Yeah, well, I part of what I try to do in this book and film is a bit of all of that, but certainly the surgical diagnosis of where to focus one's activism is really important. I mean, if we go back to theology and the idea that enlightened individuals aren't enough, what needs to happen is powerful enlightened individuals aren't enough. Powerful individuals need to be constrained. They need to be taxed. They need to be regulated. If we're thinking of the corporate elite and the billionaire class, they need to be compelled to share their wealth with the society that enabled them to get their wealth. So all of that seems fairly clear. And I think it's exactly this that we're seeing in the rise of this new corporation movement. What the movement is saying is that it's enough for us, the corporate class, to be enlightened. It's enough for us to say that we care and to actually act in some ways like we care, but not ways that affect the bottom line, unless it's a positive effect. So the whole buy or the whole positioning of the corporate capitalist class to be enlightened is very much an attempt to not be constrained. It's very much being played to say, hey, we can regulate ourselves. You don't need to regulate us. You, the democracy, don't need to make rules for us through laws. Just rely on our enlightened sensibility and we'll voluntarily do the right thing. Well, clearly that's a myth and clearly it's wrong. And you know, anybody who says that relying on enlightened individuals is going to work better than constraining them need only look at the current new corporation movement to put a lie to that. Now, the broader question, though, that you're asking, and it is the really difficult question, is we have a system that derives its legitimacy from a certain set of ideas and principles. Those are laid out in the Constitution: democratic governance, rule of law, various rights to equality, to liberty, and so on. And we abide by our government and view them as being legitimate to the extent that we believe in that system, that we respect it, and that we believe it's working. And I think the point is, and it's the point I make in the book, and it's the point that you were just making in looking at those ideas versus what's happening on the ground. And what's happening on the ground is people aren't free. They aren't equal. They don't feel democratically enfranchised. And therefore, there's this huge gap between what's happening on the ground and the principles and ideas that legitimate the system. And when you have that kind of gap, you are going to have profound instability. You're going to have polarity in society. You're going to have people shouting at each other rather than debating and discussing with each other. You're going to have what we currently have and what's being exacerbated and has been exacerbated for 4 years by Donald Trump, who himself is playing on the popular discontent with the gap between the reality and the legitimacy principles. So how do you fix that? It's difficult to fix it by continuing to insist on the legitimacy of the legitimating principles, on the rightness of our constitutional system. As much as that's true, as much as I believe as a legal scholar that it's a pretty decent system of checks and balances, and you know, one of the great achievements of humankind, really, to create this kind of Enlightenment value-fueled framework for governance. It's quite astounding, actually. As much as we as constitutional scholars and pundits and whatnot can talk about how great a system it is, if the results on the ground are not manifesting the principles up in the air, then people aren't going to buy into it. And so you see the rise of populism, not only of right-wing populism, not only in the United States and elsewhere. And you see the frustration on the progressive side of things saying, you know, the system is totally captured. What's the point in working within it? And therein you have the seeds of complete and utter breakdown. And, you know, if you're a student of history, you'll know that this is how it goes. And to think that the contemporary United States is somehow immune to the historical forces that happen time and time again, the enlightened, powerful class saying, leave it to us, putting down the power of the people, however that may manifest itself, the people becoming frustrated, societies falling apart, revolutions happening, people, you know, dying and suffering. I mean, it happens again and again throughout history. And it's remarkable that we've gone through a period of time where things felt so stable. And now that they don't, we look back on that and we say, well, I guess, yes, we are within the forces of history rather than outside of them. And that's a terrifying thing. It's a very scary thing. And how we set the thing right is, you know, on all the fronts that you mentioned. It is at the level of ideas. It is at the level of writing a book or making a film or having a podcast like this one. But it also has to be at the level of action, and it has to be at the level of politics. And what gives me hope, and again, we talked about the difference between hope and optimism. Hope is something you have to work from. Optimism is just a sense we can sit back and everything will be fine. So what gives me hope and what gives me a sense that it's worth working towards and possible to come to some kind of a better world than the one that we're in now is that people are doing it. It's happening all over the world, and it's in some ways it's happening more than it ever has. As you point out, people are pointing to the legitimating structure and saying, it's not working. It's not happening like that here on the ground. We need to change things. But I think the really important thing is not to give up on those ideals, just to understand that what we need to do is work, whether it's by running for local election or going out to a protest or writing a book or having a podcast. What we need to do is work to lessen that gap between what are a pretty good set of ideals of democracy, of social justice, of equality, a pretty good set of ideals and the absolute abdication from the aspiration towards those ideals that's happening on the ground. So let's use those ideals as a lodestar, as I believe the AOCs of the world, the Bernie Sanders of the world, the Ada Colau in Barcelona, Mayor Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi, they're not abandoning those constitutional principles and those high ideals. They're saying, let's actually realize them. Let's work to make them happen.
There's so much texture and richness in what you say. I'm an old sailor, so I'm always very fond of Odysseus and so-called siren songs of temptation. And one of my earlier guests on this podcast was the New Yorker writer Evan Osnos, who had just written an article about community of Greenwich, Connecticut, where I lived for 13 years, and how they got converted to the love of Trump. So the notion of, I think in a meta sense, the notion of stewardship on the part of these wealthy and powerful people was overwhelmed by their own greed or their own aspirations to accelerate their accumulation of material wealth. But I see, on the other side, I see some very treacherous terrain here, and I want to ask you questions to explore it. The first of which is people like Anand Giriharadas and yourself and others are saying, for the elite and powerful in corporations to change their charter from the Milton Friedman days of stock or Michael Jensen days of stockholder value to a more enlightened view, it's hard to cheer against that. In other words, it's better than not doing it. The question about credibility, I think, is important because a lot of people will say corporations that need customers for their profits will sing these songs to anesthetize your concerns about them, and that's actually good for business. It's not necessarily the case that they're going to practice what they preach, to use an old Barry White song for a moment, but how would I say, resist that siren song of temptation and greed in order to implement the things they declare are important. And I know Giriharadas stirred a lot of people up at a recent convention of corporate executives where he said, your children and grandchildren do not like what you're doing. You're not addressing inequality. You're not addressing climate change. You're not addressing pandemics and so forth. So there's this very, very difficult terrain. And I want to challenge you just a bit. I did a lot of reading about the nature of the formation of the Constitution and Bill of Rights. I remember Fred Rodell's book from Yale, 55 Men. And while I agree with you in the abstract, many of those principles stand up very nicely. I've been concerned myself that when you dig down deep into that, that was the preservation of a power structure at the same time. And maybe the principles themselves need to be re-examined also.
Well, yeah, of course, it would be a lovely thing to be able to reconstitute the United States. It's probably not going to happen. And if it does happen, it may not be in a direction that we would applaud. I mean, I look at it as a lawyer, and it's interesting because I work in two legal systems. I mean, both the United States and in Canada. And in Canada, originalism has been thoroughly rejected. So, as an interpretive framework. So, yeah, I agree. The circumstances in which the U.S. Constitution was forged are hardly ones that were laudable. I mean, we're talking about a slave economy, for example. We're talking about a system that was created to protect militias. We're talking about a system that was created to ensure judicial review under the Constitution would protect the property rights of the propertied class from the masses being represented by the democracy. So there are all kinds of problems with it. There's no question. But I guess I'm a pragmatist, and I look at our constitutional frameworks as things that are unlikely to change anytime soon. And so the sort of best approach is to think about how, for example, if I'm wanting to run for municipal politics, how to think about the ideals that underlie the enterprise I'm part of representational government, of trying to aspire towards more participatory forms, of ensuring that we see equality as an important part of our governance, and so on and so on and so on. So I guess I see the project of determining what the Constitution means as fairly fluid. And as the framework that, you know, we're working within, and one that needs to be worked with. And even when, for example, the jurisprudence on, say, freedom of expression is very problematic in providing freedom of expression rights to corporations and leading to Citizens United. This is all highly problematic and needs to be criticized. And I certainly do. But nonetheless, the fundamental ideal of freedom of expression is a good starting place. We may have debates about, you know, does that protect hate literature, for example. In Canada, it doesn't, for example. In the United States, it does. So these are fluid concepts, democracy, equality, freedom, liberty, human rights. And they're concepts that I think have a lot of room to work within. Going back to the beginning of your question, which I think is a really profound point, that it's hard not to cheer against the or for the corporate leaders who are saying, you know, we want to be more sustainable, we're using more renewable energy, fewer fossil fuels, and all of that. Isn't that better than nothing, is the question. And this is an issue I deal with at length in the book, and it's implied in the film. And the basic answer has several elements to it. One is that whatever corporate chiefs and you know, higher level management people say about how much they want to help the world, about how much they want to solve hunger or pollution or protect safety on their oil rigs or whatever it happens to be, their ultimate legal obligation is to put their shareholders' interests first. And so while they're not lying when they say we want to do good, they are potentially exaggerating the amount of good they actually can do in their jobs. I analogize it to a judge. If you're a judge in a legal system, the famous philosopher, legal philosopher Ronald Dworkin talks about a judge in the Nazi legal system. And he says, you know, if you're that judge, you can try to interpret the Nuremberg laws, you can try to interpret Nazi law in ways that are, you know, less evil rather than more evil, but ultimately your job is to interpret and apply that law. And if you don't want to do that, you have to quit. You know, another example I like to use living in Canada is ice hockey. If you're an ice hockey player, you're playing a very violent game. The rules of the game make for a violent game. And I say this as an ice hockey player, and not to criticize the game, but it's full of hard surfaces and fast skating and tenacious possession of a puck and trying to get it in the other net. There are rules that you have to play by. You don't have to be a violent. You don't have to fight. You don't have to do nasty checks of people into the board. You can decide to play a nicer game, or you can decide to play a meaner game. But you are still playing what is essentially a violent game. So the first point to make, and I make this with many, many examples in the book, talking to leaders like the former leader of BP, Lord John Brown, and talking to Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum, Jamie Dimon, all kinds of people. And I try to tease out this notion of the limits that they're working in. And so the first point I make is, yes, of course, you can do some good, but that good is always going to have to be justified as a way of doing well. And so to ask corporate leaders to be better may not be the right solution. It gets back to the point you made about, do we want powerful people to be enlightened, or do we want to constrain them? And so I think it's great as a rhetorical point that Anon sort of went into the lion's den and says, come on, you guys and gals, your children and your grandchildren are not going to like what you're doing. But I think the response of a lot of them is going to be, well, as human beings, we'd like to be doing more, but we are heads of corporations. You know, we are bound by the fiduciary obligations to our shareholders, and we're going to try, some of us, as hard as we can to line up those obligations with what's best for society and what's best for the environment. But there's only so far we can go. We can try to push the envelope, but ultimately there's an envelope. And we have to work within that envelope. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second point that you make is that better than nothing. And here's the really difficult, here's the nub of the whole problem. And this is, I think, the point I'm trying to make in my book, is that if you look at it on a case-by-case basis, it's better than nothing. It's better if a company is using more renewable energy and trying to foul the environment less. It's better if a company is trying to have greater diversity on its board. It's better if a company is voluntarily deciding to pay its workers better and give them better wages. It's better if a company makes decisions about not overly exploiting populations that are vulnerable to exploitation due to their poverty and whatnot. It's better for companies to serve and help the communities they're a part of. Of course, all of that is better if you look at it on a case-by-case basis. My point in the book is when you look at it in terms of the larger political economic movement that's happening under the guise of corporations being good now, it's worse than nothing. So the argument I make is that while each of these acts might be nice, collectively, it's part of a larger movement to push back the role of government in taking the lead on social and environmental issues, to push back the role of government in regulating corporations and requiring people to be good rather than hoping they'll voluntarily be enlightened. And that is the problem I have on the macro scale. The assault that big business has mounted over the last 20 years on the authority of democratic governments to democratically govern and to protect and promote the public interest, that assault has been justified by this recrafting of corporations' public image and to some extent their actions as good actors. And it's that that concerns me the most. And it's that I think is in part largely responsible for why we are where we are. Just to go back to 1980, and you mentioned, you know, Ronald Reagan, and we have him in the film and quote him in the book as saying, you know, governments are the problem, they're not the solution. And we have Milton Friedman, Margaret Thatcher, they're all saying the same thing. What happened is that idea that governments aren't the solution and that markets are better was an idea that was fairly vulnerable to a moral critique. For 20 years from 1980 to 2000, that was the main legitimating idea. Just, you know, governments are bad, markets are good. Governments are bad, markets are good. What happened in the early 2000s, especially with the rise of the anti-globalization movement, is people started saying, it's not enough to just keep saying markets are good. We need some kind of a narrative that shows that corporations are really trying to be good, are really recrafting themselves as good actors. And so you start to see that developing. Actually, the first major campaign is the Eco-Imagination campaign of General Electric in 2005. And you see all the major companies falling in lockstep very quickly after that. This massive rebranding, and I documented in the book, of corporations and a new legitimating story for why corporations should have the power they have, should have more power, and should push back and diminish the state. And so it's now neoliberalism with a smiling face, or now the corporate psychopath having found its charm. And to me, that's even more dangerous than what we had from 1980 to 2000, when at least the ambitions
we have a naked. Serious problem, which is that those people who are supposed to be suspicious of the psychopath need campaign contributions to remain in power. And so there is a tendency among elected officials, not all of them, but if you want to be powerful in a money politics America, you've got to make some kind of peace with those who can give you the money. And as the concentration of wealth and the scale of corporations gets so large, it becomes harder and harder to survive. And so I think that dimension would be a focal point for reform in my book. But I want to turn more generally to your notion. We have an election coming here in just the next couple of weeks. You have the Biden versus Trump possibilities in the United States. I know you grew up in America, living in Canada now, so you have a ringside seat. What would you recommend for a Biden administration's first 100 days? What do they got to do to start the process of putting things back on track?
Yeah, I mean, I think just connecting the dots between the two parts of that question, I would say that they should take very seriously the idea of overhauling the laws that relate to and that enable democratic governments and democratic politics to function. And there are obviously constitutional constraints, and those aren't going to go away, especially with the current Supreme Court as it is, from Citizens United and subsequent decisions. But I would say to work with to push against the envelope as much as possible of those constitutional constraints. And I don't think it's only in the area of electoral campaign financing. It's in the area of lobbying. It's in the area of the extent to which organizations like the American Legislative Education Committee, I think that's what ALEC stands for, can actually have an impact in writing laws. So there are many, many places and ways in which a federal government, especially in concert with sympathetic state governments, can make the law of democracy more conducive to better democratic governance. I would look at monopoly legislation because obviously part of the problem here is the extreme power that is wielded by some of these very large companies, especially in the tech sector. And so I would look at how to create a more effective anti-monopoly regime. You know, we still have acts like the Sherman Act and other acts in place, but over the years, especially since the 1980s, their enforcement has been severely undermined, not only by Republican administrations, but by Democrat administrations too. Nobody has really taken seriously the importance of reinvigorating anti-monopoly regimes, bringing them back to the point where, you know, as in 1911, the Supreme Court in the United States broke up Standard Oil. So we need to be thinking very, very seriously about that. We need to be thinking, and Joe Biden needs to think about this in the aftermath of an election victory, if that should happen, of making the regulatory state work properly, independent of the industries that it regulates. One of the real problems that we've had recently is whether it's the FAA or the FDA or the FTA, all of these bodies, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, all of these bodies have been very much compromised through not just the personnel that have been put in place, but also the cultural practices, the coziness with industry. That's an area that I think a Biden administration could work very effectively and quickly in helping set right. Obviously, in relation to that, reversing some of the ridiculous deregulation, the sort of orgy of deregulation that has happened in relation or under the Trump administration, whether it's the environment or housing, reestablishing effective social provision systems that have been gutted, whether it's housing, thinking about going beyond Obamacare in terms of a more publicly oriented health system. And I think, you know, working closely with the wing of the Democratic Party that has been dubbed progressive, which is increasingly not just at the federal level, but in city governments and state governments, importantly, and I think substantially representing a growing sentiment in the United States, especially among young people, about a direction of more proactive government, of New Deal, Green New Deal kinds of programs, and understanding that democracy is actually about self-governance, and therefore a proactive government is not something that should threaten us, but it's something we should welcome. So we need to make it work properly. And we need to make it work properly, both in process ways and in substantive ways. You know, the ultimate goal, I think, has to be to recreate a nation where people feel that government matters, where people feel that it matters in their lives, whether they're trying to go to college or retrain for a new job or get housing or eat. Or have their kids in decent schools, have some measure of equality across school systems, feel that it's their right to have a good education, that it's their right to have water, that it's their right to have utilities or Wi-Fi, that the internet is not just a place of sort of enclaves of corporate domination and data mining. So there are so many things that I think a Biden administration could do, not just in a technical sense, but in a way that is strongly supported and politically viable. And I'm very much hoping, well, two things. One, that there is a Biden administration and not a Trump administration. And two, that administration takes seriously the notion that for 40 years, we have been pushing back and gutting the system, the social system that actually makes democracy.
My last focus, and it's not something you and I have discussed together previously, is related to these large scale internet platforms and what some are calling the surveillance state, or what Naomi Klein has referred to as the Green New Deal. How, when the internet was originally celebrated as a way of bringing more voices to the surface, stopping the intermediaries, the tastemakers who might be subject to corruption, from getting in the way of democratic discourse. But I sense a lot of troubled feelings now. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that specific realm and the, how do you say, role of governance in the design regulation. I'll mention one of my friends who lives in Canada, who's on my governing board, Roe Hinton Medora, gave a lovely speech at the Pontifical Academy of Social Science before Pope Francis last fall. And what he said at the time was, we have a Food and Drug Administration. We test things out. And then when they look like they do good and not much harm, or to the best of our knowledge, that's when we release drugs. In the realm of technology, we put things out and find out what harm it does, but then you're battling powerful people to try to get them to change course or rescind the introduction of the product. How do you want to approach these very, very, what you might call powerful forces of increasing returns and scale, and the internet monopolies that appear to be, according to the film The Social Dilemma, at times even fomenting civil war, not to mention challenging the mental development of children?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental argument I make in my book is that the big tech industry has said, you know, we're new, we're different, we can't be regulated, we shouldn't be regulated. But what I suggest in the book is consistent with the idea that, you know, the Food and Drug Administration regulates potentially dangerous products. Why don't we do that with the internet? What I argue with the book is that the big tech sector may present new challenges and may have different kinds of business models and a new technology than the industries that originally led to the rise of the regulatory state. But what's not new about it is the idea that it is releasing technologies that can cause harm, and that democratic governments have an obligation to the populations and the citizens that elect them to protect the public interest from harm. And so how that plays out, I mean, there are so many different ways we can talk about the harm that is caused by big tech. I wrote a book in 2011 called Childhood Under Siege, How Big Business Harms Your Children. And in it, I spend quite a bit of time on the different ways, for example, that the gaming industry aims at young, impressionable children, and with a specific and scientific-based agenda to get them addicted and to get them to spend more money, whether on virtual pets or on various kinds of games and whatnot. I think the problem goes way beyond that. The problem goes beyond that in the sense that we have, for example, Facebook and Twitter becoming weaponized by hate groups, weaponized by groups that have the intention to undermine our democratic institutions, that are organizing often very dangerous and subversive kinds of acts that are based on hatred, that are based on xenophobia, that are based on racism. And then we have the more general problem that relying on these platforms for our news, for the most part, we all end up in our own echo chambers. We all end up, and this is well documented, having our beliefs reinforced, including racist beliefs, including sexist beliefs, including all of these corrosive beliefs. But we end up in a world where every individual has their own sort of bubble of media content and news and information, and we can no longer talk to each other. The advantage of the old system of, you know, legacy newspapers like the New York Times and the Boston Globe or the Toronto Globe and Mail setting the agenda, the advantage of it was that we all got the same news, and that created a certain kind of social solidarity. In education, there were curricula that were fairly common, and so we all had the same kinds of things to argue and debate about. Now, the clear disadvantage of that is those systems get hijacked by those with interest and those with power, and so we end up leaving out a lot of things that people should know about. We end up having curricula or having newspapers that don't report on issues that are crucial around race or around gender or around economic disparity and so forth. So there are both disadvantages to having gatekeepers and advantages, but completely doing away with that kind of sort of journalistic ethical screening of information and leaving it instead to for-profit companies that have business models that profit from increasing traffic and therefore benefit from controversy, benefit from hate, benefit from all of these kinds of very toxic discourses that, whatever else they might do, increase traffic, increase the amount of time people spend on these platforms. That is, I think, more problematic than trying to figure out a way to curate knowledge in ways that serve democracy, that serve debate, that serve discourse, rather than completely undermine it. I mean, this is difficult terrain because we're talking about a context of free speech. But the problem is that free speech ends up getting undermined by these platforms because the whole idea animating free speech is to have a polity where we can have civil democratic debates about our collective destiny. And there's no question that the kind of Wild West curated or not by for-profit corporations with business models based on increasing traffic, that is not working. So we've dealt with this in the past. I mean, we've had debates and discussions in different degrees in different countries about what is the role government should play in broadcasting. So in Canada, where I live, we have a government-funded broadcaster, the CBC, that has quite a large footprint on media, has legislative obligations to perpetuate public debate, does not have advertising on its radio stations and so forth. In Britain, we have the BBC. So we've had this debate. The horse has left the stable. We know that we can't just sort of allow this Wild West. We need to figure out ways from a policy perspective to ensure that we have debate and discussion that is civil, that isn't about hatred, that all of these sorts of things, that this sort of reactive and simplistic idea of freedom of speech can sometimes undermine the very purposes that underlie free speech. We know all of this. We've had these debates. We need to have them again in relation to these large platforms. We need to think seriously about breaking them up. The problem with a platform like Facebook is it's driven by what are called network effects. Its business model is driven by the need for monopoly. Facebook doesn't work unless everybody's on it or lots and lots of people are on it. That's its business model. So it has to monopolize the social media space or it dies. So it needs to keep expanding because of these network effects. So we really need to think about whether our monopoly laws should be applied to these kinds of monopolies and how that can be done in a way that helps rather than hurts public discourse. I'm not saying we shouldn't have social media, but perhaps we should have social media in different ways. Perhaps, like with broadcasting, we should ensure that there are different channels, that there isn't just one provider. So we need to really think about those kinds of ways of approaching this. I think the really terrifying aspect of it all, though, is the data mining, and we need to think about that as well. Because as I show in my book, and as Professor Zuboff at Harvard has shown in her book Surveillance Capitalism, and I rely on a lot of her work, the problem isn't so much about the fact that data mining is invading our privacy. That is a problem. The real problem, though, is that the information that's being gathered is ultimately being used and going to be used more to control us. The obvious example is your car insurance company can detect when you're driving over the speed limit and might automatically end your insurance policy. That's an example that Professor Zuboff talks about. But if you're an Amazon employee, you've got your scanner, which has a built-in software to enable the managers to follow every footstep, to follow how fast you're doing, how fast you're picking in the warehouse, all of these performance metrics, and to effectively control every move that you're making from on high, because you are providing this information in real time to them through your scanner. So, I mean, those are just two kind of obvious examples, but it's hard to and scary to imagine how all this data is going to reflect back on us in terms of being controlled directly by companies, whether in our roles as consumers or our roles as workers. And so that's another area that I think governments really need to be thinking about. They need to be thinking about how your basic labor standards that are designed to protect employees from undue exploitation can be made effective in a context where technology is allowing this real-time feedback loop. The tech companies are always saying, oh, it's impossible to regulate us, even if it were a good idea, we can't be regulated. Well, that's not true. You could pass a law That said, you're not allowed to have those kinds of real-time feedback loops from the scanners of Amazon employees. There's nothing that stops a government from doing that in a technical sense. And that might be the kind of thing that governments need to think about to ensure that we don't revert back to 19th century working conditions through 21st century technologies.
Well, Joe, when you talked earlier about hope and optimism, it comes to me to say that after almost 70 minutes of conversation, to experience someone with the intensity and the suppleness and the depth and the sense of purpose certainly makes me hopeful, but it makes me much more optimistic because we are navigating very difficult pathways towards the future of a healthy and wholesome and trustworthy society. And the suppleness and the lateral pattern recognition and the way in which you pursue this and your persistence in raising these things, I think is a great gift to humankind. And I want to thank you for that and for being here and sharing your vision and your ideas with me today.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I appreciate your having me on the show, and I appreciate
when we find out.
So, thank you for
who wins the election, and they start to build cabinets of people and representatives. I'd love to have you back on and do a Zoom on the question, some of which we explored today, about what's necessary in those first 100 days. Great. Thanks again for today. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Rob.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.